Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. So keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left. Speaking today with Dale Carrico. Dale is a PhD, almost to be a PhD, in the Department of Rhetoric at the University of California at Berkeley, and he's writing a dissertation on pancritics, technological transformations on the subject of privacy. He organized the 13th annual Boundaries in Question conference last year on the topic of new feminist perspectives on biotechnology and bioethics, and he's going to be organizing a conference this next fall, 2005, on human enhancement and human rights. Welcome, Dale.
Hi.
I also know you because you write a column with me, alongside me, in Better Humans. Your column's called Progressive Futures, and we collaborate in the Cyborg Democracy blog together, and you have a blog of your own called M.R. Mundy. So we do quite a few things in the same space, in cyberspace. One of the things I want to talk to you about today is, as you know, the articles that you've been writing recently about your reflections on the state of tech progressive politics. Uh-huh. But before we get there, why don't we go back? Because I think it's always a surprise for those who aren't familiar with our tinier neck of the woods over here, the liberal and progressive neck of the tech progressive woods. How we would have ended up here in the first place. I don't think people are surprised when, you know, people who work in biotech or people who are computer engineers or something end up with these kinds of enthusiasms. But, you know, you're in the postmodernist Department of Rhetoric studying under Judith Butler, one of the leading postmodernists in the world. So how did you get interested in the notion of radical longevity and all the other things that we talk about?
Right, I'm in the belly of the beast at Berkeley. Well, I mean, for me, it feels like the most natural thing in the world, if I can use the word natural in that context. It wouldn't have occurred to me that people who are enthusiasts about technology and their empowering effects wouldn't also be drawn to progressive politics if I weren't confronted with so many people who end up being really kind of facile libertopian conservatives who are enthusiasts about technology. I mean, I found that very surprising myself. But it feels to me like I've always been interested in technology and the politics of technology. I can't actually remember a time when I wasn't fascinated by science and technology. I cherished science fiction by writers like Heinlein and Arthur C. Clarke and the Dune books when I was a kid. I read popular science books by Sagan and folks like that. I love the progressive optimism of the Star Trek universe. I subscribe to Omni magazine. I was just going through the internet last night while I was preparing for this interview, and I came upon a letter to the editor that I wrote to Time magazine in 1984. This is 20 years ago. And in it, I read, this is the quote from the letter to the editor: "I was overjoyed and excited by the medical breakthroughs reported in your story, especially the artificial heart." This was in a medicine column from December 10th of 1984. "As a 19-year-old, I refused to accept the probability of disease, the inevitability of death, or my, quote, duty to die, unquote."
That's pretty funny.
it was really quite shocking to come upon it, because I only half remembered even writing this letter to the editor, and to find it there on the internet was really one of those kind of serendipitous confrontations. And I don't know if I was more surprised to realize that I'm still humming exactly the same tune after 20 years, or to realize that it also means I've been a student for 20 years. But it's been a perfectly consistent perspective for me to advocate progressive politics, and then to feel an enthusiasm about the capacity of technologies to be emancipatory. And I think that that's a relatively traditional position for the left as well. I think it is only very recently that the left has become quite suspicious of the technology, and have become really quite skeptical of the idea of progress. And I think that's a thing that we need to address, you and I and other cyborg Democrats.
Well, what's your natural history of left techno-skepticism? I mean, the story that I like to tell is that the left, that there were two traditions, two shadow traditions within progressive thought for the last 400 years, one which wanted to reject technology and one which wanted to use it to revolutionize society.
Right, a very romantic vision, right?
Right, and that it was World War II that kind of flipped it around. But in your analysis of this intellectual history and cultural history, what are the key events?
Well, it's really hard to say, actually. I know that one of the tricky things is that a lot of the enthusiasm for technology at the moment is coming from the political right, and I mean, that's obviously because there's just so much money to be made there, right? The suspicion of technology on the left for progressive people just comes from the fact that they've learned some hard lessons. They've come to think of technology as a shorthand for simply environmental degradation, corporate welfare, and military hardware. And I mean, they're not making that stuff up wholesale. It's just that they've relinquished the alternatives to that.
Yeah, I think that one of the things I would point to is the rise of environmentalism, which kind of cast a pall over all kinds of techno enthusiasms. If technology was, you know, part of a machine of civilization that was going to destroy the planet, then, you know, the progressives have a right to have a duty to stop technology as a whole.
Right. Although, I mean, there are alternate voices available even at the heights of those kind of romantic enthusiasms. I mean, I remember, gosh, what was his name? Bookchin's book, Post-Scarcity Anarchism, was an environmentalist idea that was just saturated by techno-optimism. I don't know if you're familiar with Bookchin.
Actually, it's an interesting part of my own intellectual history that when in 1987, when I first came back from Sri Lanka from Japan in that time to the
right.
States, the U.S. Green Party was just getting organized. There are now two parallel green organizations in the States, but back then there was this one founding convention up in Vermont someplace. And the big fight at that convention was between the Bookchinites, who called themselves social ecologists, and the deep ecologists.
Right.
And then I started Eco-Socialist Review right after that and started aligning ourselves as kind of the eco-socialists, we called ourselves. And the eco-socialists were kind of a third group between the anarchism of the social ecologists and the misanthropy of the deep ecologists. But Bookchin's critiques of the misanthropy of the deep ecologists continue to ring true to this day. And it's one of the reasons I became a transhumanist, because I saw the kind of pervading return to natural law and this notion of the natural, which you write so eloquently about, kind of pervading progressive thought.
Right. I agree with you that they still ring true. It's just the surprising thing is they don't really quite seem to resonate for some reason. Although, I mean, both in Bruce Sterling's Viridian Greens and in the world-changing folks, you've just had Jemai Cassio participate in your program last week, I think. They're both coming from a rather technophilic environmentalist perspective that might renew some of that critique, so that's rather exciting. But I guess to go back to your earlier question of why I haven't been personally articulated by those kind of technophobic brands of the left, it occurs to me that the reason's actually pretty obvious, and that is my political radicalization came through queer politics and very specifically queer forms of feminist politics as well, for which the natural just simply doesn't have the normative weight that you often find in left politics.
Well, one of the things that you've eloquently written about is that we're too queer to go back at this point, that the
right.
Society, you make this connection between, you know, the concept of queerness and the how changed we are as modern cyborgs.
Right. Well, In my understanding of what the queer actually means, I mean, queerness and prostheticization, right, are very, very similar sorts of phenomena. I mean, through prosthetic practices, we rewrite ourselves in the image of our desires to an important extent. I mean, there's no guarantee that we'll succeed, but we go to altogether new places. And I mean, a politics of desire, if we learn anything from queer politics, it's not going to stabilize around these normative categories. Freedom isn't going to be about that. So, I mean, I think that the lesson of queer politics is really quite instructive for technophiles on the left, and it gives us an opening. And there are lots of connections to feminist politics around reproductive freedom and reproductive technologies that also kind of widen that queer critique in very useful ways for technophile politics of the left. It's just that I don't think they've really been elaborated quite as much as they eventually surely will.
Well, you and I have talked quite a bit about how many constituencies we would think would have a natural affinity with the notion of technological self-emancipation, and yet don't see, you know, for various reasons, various critiques are hostile to it. But I recently I've been engaging in a bit of an intervention on a list called Bioethics. It's on Yahoo.
Uh-huh.
And it was set up by our sometimes friend Gregor Wallbring, who's a he's what I would consider, but he wouldn't necessarily consider, a victim of thalidomide. And he has become one of the leading researchers on the chemical and medical uses of thalidomide.
Uh-huh.
But he's also a bioethicist who's been very active in the disability rights movement. And he's sometimes written about how transhumanists and bioethicists should be allies. But then, you know, and when he gets back into his disability rights milieu, then they're all beating up on us and everybody else in the world for wanting to kill disabled people. But I've been arguing with them and saying, look, you know, people in the transhumanist movement have a couple positions that you consider to be hostile to disabilities, such as that we generally think people should have a right to make reproductive choices that might include abortion or selective genetic alteration that would get rid of certain kinds of disabilities in their potential future children. And that freaks a lot of people with disabilities out. But we are totally on the same page when it comes to a conscious adult disabled person's right to have the full technological resources to achieve their fullest potential in the world, and to not have anybody else tell them whether they do or don't need to have legs, or do or don't need to have some kind of surgery, or whatever they want to do with their own body. And
well,
it seems,
exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, it's actually sometimes difficult to understand why there would be such blanket hostility in disability studies to the kinds of, like, anti-normative moves that prosthetic practice would want to emphasize, because obviously what happens with prosthetic practices is that potentially you proliferate in an unimaginable way the varieties of incarnation available to humanity. And, I mean, that would seem to me to actually remove all sorts of, like, stigmas and regulatory opportunities that devalue people with disability. I mean, I think that they can only imagine the proliferation of ways of being in the world as this strangely genocidal fantasy, when it seems to me exactly the opposite of that. It seems to be an unleashing of varieties of ways of being legitimately in the world that should, I don't know, open opportunities for all sorts of different ways of valuing other people. So it's very confusing to me why that side isn't highlighted in so-called disability studies. I like Zach Lynch's discussion of enablement, right? Technological enablement that actually it refuses the discussion of disability altogether. It talks about differing enablements.
Well, I'm speaking with Dale Carrico. He's a PhD. Are you a PhD yet?
I'm a PhD candidate, presumably. Designation.
You're just about ready to turn in your dissertation. So
I've been ready for quite some time.
We're all crossing our fingers that there will be no more obstacles in calling you Dr. Carrico in a very short order.
That sounds very exciting.
And he's a fellow with the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies, and he writes at Better Humans, and he's also a participant in the Cyborg Democracy blog. So many, many connections between Dale and myself.
Right.
Well, back to this issue of why certain groups don't like technological self-empowerment that we would think should. One of the arguments that comes up from many different quarters is that we give people control over their genomes or their bodies or their minds, that there's going to be some kind of overwhelming social pressure for conformity and normativity that will, and that society will then become just a carbon copy of 1950s or whatever.
Right.
And, you know, I'm sure that both of you and I are a little bit sympathetic with the desire to protect diversity. But as you just alluded, it doesn't seem like technological self-empowerment is going to reduce the amount of diversity in the world. It seems like it's going to increase it.
Right. It's hard to understand why new practices of prosthetic reinvention would necessarily impose conformity. I mean, why would it police diversity out of existence? It seems to me more likely that there would be an explosion of diversity that would follow in the aftermath of the arrival of those kinds of options. I think that if you want evidence of that, look at the really quite timid kinds of modification that are available to us today compared to the kind of radical modifications that we're anticipating. Already, people are engaging in really quite radical practices of bodily self-modification, all sorts of individualizing practices of self-creation with the modest tools that are available to us today. I think that we see those presaging really rather exciting transformations in the future. It's precisely the fear of that that drives, that is the urgency beneath bioconservative movements to repudiate possibilities, it seems to me.
You weren't at the Transvision conference at Yale a year and a half ago.
No, but
we had what's her name? I'm spacing on the woman's name, but we had a trans woman there who's the leader of NTAC, the National Transgender Action Coalition, and she gave a wonderful presentation about how transgendered people, transsexuals in particular, were some of the first transhumanists because they had taken the power of, taken control over their own bodies in that way. And I think it's very interesting to note that one of the most eloquent of the recent critiques, Fukuyama doesn't touch the topic, nor does Cass, to my knowledge, although he's written about everything else, including food. But
he'll
get to it eventually. But one person who has addressed transgender is Carl Elliott, who's a liberal kind of greenish critiquer of self-transformative technologies in his book called Better Than Well.
Right.
Which we've adopted. We've taken the, you call us queer? Well, we are queer thing by adopting in the WTA, the World Transhumanist Association, Better Than Well as a slogan. So I'm not sure he's picked up on that yet. But at any rate, his book Better Than Well, he compares people who want to undergo transsexual surgery to people who have healthy legs that they feel should be taken off so that they can be fully who they want to be. And there's a name for this syndrome, which is completely unpronounceable. But and a lot of transgender folks have taken huge umbrage of that at that.
Well, of course.
And I think it is very interesting that, this is a theme. Now, Carl Elliott's work's being cited by Christian fundamentalists who are saying that transgender is just a form of mental illness and it should be treated as such.
As though to step from the normative bounds of human form as they are constituted in this very parochial moment is going to be regarded as mutilation. I mean, it's unintelligible to me.
Right. But it does raise, on the other hand, on the other side of the equation, it raises for us what our own limits are. I mean, our limits shouldn't be defined by a yuck factor about any of this. But, we do have to have some grounds for saying that sometimes when people want to kill themselves or sometimes when they want to castrate themselves or cut off their leg, that we do have some right to stop them until we can figure out when it's appropriate to allow them to do that.
Right. I mean, in an important sense, the thing that drives the emotional undercurrent, the anxiety about the sorts of technologies we're talking about is actually we're talking about a new limit. We're not just overcoming all limits, as you hear some people globally say. I mean, we're actually introducing a new limit into the discussion, and that is this. We now have the new limit that we no longer know what the limits are. I mean, we can no longer use intelligible, customary limits to have a clearly shared, intelligible sense of what we're capable of, what finitude is going to mean to our generation. It provides a series of standards on the basis of which we can communicate what it means to live meaningfully, right? Technology is going to take away those comforting limits and introduce the new limit that each generation is going to have to redefine for itself what the limits are, what the project of being human is going to be. I mean, it's an incredibly imposing and risky and vulnerable making thing to lose, right? But it's not that I don't agree with bioconservatives who say that the technophiles are all, at least all of them are driven by a superhuman passion to overcome all limits. I think that we're going to find a new expression of finitude. It's just not going to be particularly comforting in the way that finitude may have seemed comforting to conservatives in the past. I don't think that the role of finitude is going to be that. I think we're going to derive our meaning from our individual projects of self-creation and the way we communicate them with one another. So, I mean, limits are still going to be part and parcel of the human experience, whatever that comes to mean, you know?
I'm speaking with Dale Carrico. He's a PhD candidate in the Department of Rhetoric at the University of California at Berkeley. He's writing a dissertation, finished a dissertation now, on Pancritics, the Technological Transformations of the Subject. What, is that still the title?
It's not quite finished. I'm working on the last chapter now, and in fact, I have to throw a conclusion together. But the light at the end of the tunnel is definitely there. And it's called Pancryptics.
Pancryptics, sorry.
Pancryptics, right. It connects a lot of discourses around privacy and information theory. And pancryptics comes to actually be a word that describes the kind of dream that information science could exhaustively describe the world, that actually all knowledge is almost like an encrypted set of secrets in the book of nature that we're trying to learn and we're going to intervene in.
Have you had time to look at Neal Stephenson's System of the World books?
I've read the first of the trilogy, but the phone book-like character of each of the subsequent books has kind of intimidated me. I can't ever sit down and open it up when I know that I have a dissertation to finish.
His approach to science fiction is about the same as your approach to prose.
Mm.
Which I promise
never
I will
stop.
Yeah, never stop, exactly. Which I promised I did. I will tell your dissertation committee that your approach to completely describing something is one of your great virtues. If they don't yet understand that.
Well, I don't know. You know, in the dissertation, I'm really I do get to talk about technocultural and technoethical issues, which is my passion in the dissertation. But of course, it's a very small, anemic, circumscribed part of that conversation, and I'm mostly focusing my attention on media criticism and intellectual property discussions around digital networks and digital media. But it's very difficult in participating in this kind of ritual of professionalization not to realize that all the while that I've been writing the dissertation, I mean, I've also started and then participated in these blogs, right? My personal blog and then the blog I do with you and the columns too. I mean, there are all of these online writings that I'm contributing to while I'm working on the writing and research of the dissertation. And it's very palpable. I mean, it's day and night, the difference of those two experiences of writing in my life. And I have to say, I think that I see some really interesting lessons for the academy in that difference, because
I want to go there, because I think you are an example of someone trying to balance the public intellectual role. All of us who do the blogs and the writing for Better Humans and whatnot are trying to be public intellectuals of one kind or another. But I think it's most difficult, I see, for people like you and Russell Blackford in Australia, who's along there beside us, who are people who are looking forward to jobs in the academy.
Right.
Because not only both the content and the form of what is good as a public intellectual may invalidate you in some people's eyes in the academy.
Right. I have to say, I mean, when I'm writing an argument for the dissertation, about halfway through the construction and articulation of the argument, I start to be bedeviled by the feeling that I'm just belaboring the point to an absurd degree, right? The professional requirements of making a professional research argument for the purposes of publication in the academy, I mean, they seem to actually be a series of almost absurd exactions. I find myself thinking, you know, I could come up with a somewhat half-baked but provocative formulation of this idea, make a blog post of it, circulate it to the friends I have that I respect quite a lot, and together, in a kind of conversational mode, we could hammer out a really quite vibrant and nuanced and you know, powerfully documented set of arguments that would intervene into the very same reality that I'm trying to deal with in research infinitely more effectively. It's just I don't know that the professional publication modes that I would normally associate with the academy are necessarily keeping up with what is now available to us in digital networks. I mean, I got my MA in a very conservative Anglo-American philosophy of science program at the Georgia State University in Atlanta 10 years ago, and I wrote a thesis to get that MA called Technology and Proliferating Queer Bodies, 120 pages or so, right? To be honest, the column I wrote for Better Humans, Technologies Making Queers of Us All, about a year ago, was able to say in 6 pages, honestly, almost everything that I found particularly valuable or interesting in the entire dissertation. And I have the sinking suspicion that in the aftermath of finishing this dissertation, I'll be able to write a handful of blog posts or columns or articles, a tenth of the length, in which most of the things that excite me about the ideas in the dissertation are expressed. And I can probably, you know, weave them into public conversations that are so much more effective and interesting and provocative than anything that is going to happen with this massive tome that's taken me, what? God, I think I've been writing it literally as long as I've known you.
Well,
like almost 4 years.
I completely sympathize. I mean, my dissertation had a lot of bits and pieces that were hammered together. It wasn't one coherent argument, but I did publish the core of the argument in a very short journal article piece that I think said as much as I needed to say out of mine. So,
right.
I agree with you. I think that, you know, the larger point is that academe encourages an increasing subspecialization and marginalization of our intellectual work into these tiny little niches that we have to validate ourselves to, and that will have absolutely no effect on the world. And,
right.
And those who really want to publicly engage have to write in a completely different way.
I mean, on the other hand, I have to say that for me, being first a student and then a graduate student, I mean, I literally have been in the university for like 20 years now. I mean, the experience of being a student is a kind of utopian experience. I'm going to really miss it when I leave it. If I imagine what the kind of world I would want, it would be one in which everyone can just be perpetually a student and participate in the kind of life that has been available to me. I think that it's actually a kind of incomparable institution. The fact that it's respected is really quite wonderful because it's relatively progressive. It is one of the few places, especially in American society, where you can actually intelligibly talk about the kind of erotic pleasure of thinking. I mean, you can discuss diverse, challenging ideas and be valued in American society, in the academy. It's an extraordinary place that way.
You've been listening to the first half of an interview with Dale Carrico, the Human Rights Fellow at the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. Dale blogs at the Amor Mundi blog and also at the Cyborg Democracy blog. He writes the Progressive Futures column for BetterHumans.com. You can listen to the second half of this interview next week on Change Surfer Radio or listen to it online at changesurfer.com. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts with me, Dr. J, you can contact me at jhughes@changesurfer.com. That's jhughes@changesurfer.com. Or you can read my Change Surfing columns at betterhumans.com or check out the collaborative Cyborg Democracy blog I participate in at cyborgdemocracy.net. Or you can read my new book, Citizen Cyborg. For more details about Citizen Cyborg, visit cyborgdemocracy.net. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3, thanks to the A Infos Radio Project. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.